Since this podcast was recorded, the AHSN network has been renamed the Health Innovation Network. To find out more about the new names of the local health innovation networks described in this discussion as academic health science networks, visit thehealthinnovationnetwork.co.uk.
We've all learned a lot since the coronavirus pandemic. New ways of working involving digital technology are now commonplace, and COVID-19 highlighted the need for more equal care for all. Innovation during a crisis is hugely important, but so is taking time to evaluate new models of care to make sure future services are set up in the best way for everyone, including the health and care teams that provide them. The NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme, or NIP for short, is funded by NHS England's Accelerated Access Collaborative and jointly run by the Applied Research Collaborations and the AHSN Network. This rapid evaluation programme has been set up specially to look at 14 different innovation projects to see how best to take them forward post-pandemic. In this series of podcasts, we'll hear how health inequalities are being highlighted and tackled, and how the prioritisation programme is making a difference across England. There's lots to listen out for in this series of podcasts. I'm Nigel Thompson. Joining us in this edition, Aoife Molloy, who's NHS England's Senior Clinical Advisor for Health and Equality, and also Professor Jo Dunville, a Professor of Applied Research at the University of Manchester, where she leads the Manchester Wounds Research Group. Both, thanks very much for joining us. And Aoife, I can start with you first of all. Tell us a bit about this issue. I mentioned briefly what it includes, but you look at this in detail. What is it in brief terms?
So thanks very much, Nigel. We know that healthcare inequalities are systematic, avoidable, and unfair differences in health status between different groups of people. And the key thing about this is that they're actually avoidable differences. This means they're just more than mere variation in healthcare, and we can intervene. So we've got lots of opportunities. The COVID pandemic, as you've already said, really highlighted healthcare inequalities and shone a really harsh light on inequalities in outcomes that have been persistent in the NHS for many, many years and many decades. We've seen disproportionate deaths from COVID-19 between those living in deprived areas and those in least deprived areas. But we've also seen staggering ethnic inequalities across the healthcare in the pandemic in the NHS. Lots of different studies have showed us that these inequalities are pervasive and persistent throughout healthcare, and they have a huge role to play in economic disadvantage, ill health, reduced quality of life, and indeed reduced life. I work with Professor Bola Owalabi in the National Healthcare Inequalities Improvement Team, and I'm the Senior Clinical Advisor for Healthcare Inequalities Improvement. And we're really trying to focus attention on the very important priority areas of the Core 20 plus 5 strategy. The Core 20 are the population that are 20% of the most deprived in our country. And this is defined by the Index of Multiple Deprivation. The Index of Multiple Deprivation covers 7 domains of reasons for deprivation, of which health is only one. So we do recognize that there is a very important role of the social determinants of health in health outcomes. But using all our tools and levers and all our lessons from the COVID pandemic, we can really make a difference to about 20% of health outcomes by directly working through the NHS. And this is why we have a vision in the Health Inequalities Improvement Team, which is excellent quality of healthcare for all. And the emphasis is really on the all. And this is by improving experience and then improving equity of access to improve outcomes for all.
So the strategy is quite detailed from what you've said. You've laid it out very clearly, but I think the thing that's in probably many people's minds is that every area of England is different. There's different kind of crisis, you know, different issues at the heart of places, and also different partners to work with as well. So there isn't an easy, I imagine, really one size fits all. So having set out how and who you aim to try and help, how practically do you go about actually achieving that?
Exactly. And I think, you know, the COVID vaccination campaign has taught us a lot about how working with communities and community leaders and bringing the NHS to the people is really how we can tackle healthcare inequalities really effectively. So in the Core 20 plus 5 the strategy. The plus group is locally determined at an ICS level, and this is where groups that may or may not be included in the deprivation group can be catered for. And the flexibility is there to include people who are living with healthcare inequalities. For example, people with inclusion health needs, like vulnerable migrants, or people living with cognitive impairment or dementia, or people living with mental illness. And so this plus group allows the flexibility for the local ICSs to direct their efforts at those that need it most. And then the five is the five key clinical areas. And so these allow us to focus even further in on the key five clinical areas that have the biggest gap in terms of outcomes between deprived and least deprived communities, or indeed ethnic differences.
How do you spread the word, given that there are people who are extremely busy, you know, in the day job, as it were, but to learn what you're doing, to take a real active interest, how do you communicate with people who are already busy?
That's a really good question. And I think in the NHS, that's often a real challenge. You know, people think that surely the NHS is all linked up and talking to each other, but that you're right, trying to create this culture change and this positive improvement it is really challenging. So what we are doing is setting up a lot of national support offers to really empower communities and the NHS to work together. So we have our Core 20 Plus Connectors program, which are funded community champions who are helping to really articulate the voice of their community, but also bring the NHS to the people. And these are usually people who were working in the COVID vaccination campaign as community champions. They're faith leaders, they're youth group leaders, they're tea and coffee groups, you know, so they've really got the local people at the heart of everything they do, but they're connected in with us in the national team and with the regional leads for healthcare inequalities. So we've got that kind of huge national network going in terms of the Core 20 Plus connectors. We also have the Core 20 Plus ambassadors, who are clinicians and professionals all across the whole country. And these are active professionals and managers and clinicians who are working to tackle healthcare inequalities locally. And they form an expert peer reference group that check in with us regularly. We give them lots of opportunities, but they do all the amazing work. And then they can share the learning in a community of practice online. And then we also have our healthcare inequalities improvement dashboard, which is being refined and improved all the time. But this dashboard is a really important tool for looking at all the normal targets of the NHS, but through an intersectional lens of the inequalities, for example, deprivation, ethnicity, gender, age. And this allows us to really delve into the detail of the statistics. And this, again, is a lesson from the COVID pandemic. We saw in the National Audit Office report that, you know, we thought we had good coverage of the COVID vaccination with 80% of the population covered. But when we looked at that 20%, we realized that this was a lot of people living with inequalities who were often excluded from healthcare outcomes. So working with communities and clinical champions from the communities, we were really able to get vaccination rates from 30% in Black African communities up to 80% in a matter of weeks. And this kind of success in a public health intervention is almost unprecedented. And this is really the sort of essence of what we're trying to do with working with communities and champions to really tackle healthcare inequalities. All of this information is shared on the NHS Future platform for healthcare inequalities. And there are regular monthly meetings with the Healthcare Inequalities Network and Healthcare Inequalities Forum. So we're working on making a lot of opportunities to build a big culture change.
Aoife, it's great to hear. Obviously, lots going on. I'm going to hear from two case studies and two examples in this podcast very shortly as well. But thanks very much for your time so far. And please stay with us for the rest of the podcast. And also joining us is Professor Joe Dunville. Joe is the Professor of Applied Health Research at the University of Manchester. Thanks for joining us. And that isn't the only thing that you do. You also lead the Manchester Wounds Research Group. And I know that you specialise in nursing and midwifery. Hearing what you've just heard, what's your reaction? What's your assessment of how things are changing after the pandemic?
So thanks very much. And I think it's really interesting to hear that information from NHS England. And it really chimes with what we found in Greater Manchester as part of the work that we were doing, which was specifically focused on vaccination during the pandemic and trying to maximise the insights that were gained during that period, which was often seeing activity that was being done very rapidly and very responsively to acute situations. So we saw the COVID pandemic obviously resulting in massive mass vaccination campaigns, which were delivered rapidly across the UK, often using mass vaccination centres and primary care. But as Aoife said, we know that just like COVID had an unequal impact on groups from the outset, there were inequalities in vaccination for COVID as well. So we know from research that was undertaken at the University of Manchester that across Greater Manchester there was inequity in COVID vaccinations, this being relatively lower in most ethnic people from ethnic minority backgrounds. And it was interesting to observe that inequalities in vaccination for COVID were more pronounced when it was compared with other mass vaccination programs, sometimes happening at the same time, like flu vaccination. So there were specific issues around COVID vaccinations and inequity in receipt of the vaccinations that we wanted to look at as part of our work in this area.
I know that places like Bolton are very much part of Greater Manchester. And I recall that during the early days of the pandemic, that was one area that was very badly affected in terms of numbers. Because of the diverse population of Greater Manchester, how do you kind of build, not trust, but how do you build an understanding that the work that you and your health colleagues are doing is aimed at helping all sections of the community?
Yeah, so Manchester has a population of almost 3 million people, say, with health and social care delivered across 10 localities. And as you say, it's a diverse population across all of those areas. And we knew that across these 10 localities during the course of the pandemic, and indeed before the pandemic, building up to it, vaccination is obviously a public health intervention. And it would be naive to think that new knowledge was only generated during the pandemic. There'd obviously been years of accrued insight that were then leveraged on as during the pandemic. And we wanted to make sure that we captured that and also maximise learning from the acute situation that the pandemic caused. And so we knew there were lots of targeted vaccination activities to try and improve vaccination equity across Greater Manchester. And these approaches were often being developed rapidly with multifaceted approaches, recognising steps in identification of groups and communities that were underserved in terms of vaccination, thinking about root causes and designing targeted activities to respond to these. So the work we did was really at a somewhat macro level, trying to understand more about these activities and use this learning to shape ongoing work. And it aimed to ensure an organisational record of activity to cascade learning forward. So there were kind of multiple steps to what we did. And first of all, we actually took a step back and we wanted to make sure that we were completely aware of what research evidence existed in this space of trying to improve targeted vaccination in underserved groups. So we did something called a rapid review, where we wanted to systematically but quickly try and gather together all relevant research evidence in this area to make sure that activities that were aiming to support targeted vaccination in Greater Manchester were maximally drawing from available insights that had been generated from other research projects. So we did that and then summarised that information and used it to explore in Greater Manchester some of the activities that were underway to consider what was having a sort of purposeful impact, explore barriers and facilitators to different targeted vaccination approaches so we could maximise this wider learning from the pandemic going forward. So, as I said before, vaccination more broadly is an ongoing public health aim. And there are other key public health interventions that can leverage learning from what happened during the pandemic. So to do that, we spoke to over 30 key stakeholders alongside undertaking surveys and group discussions to try and understand some of the core themes that supported targeted vaccination in Greater Manchester during the pandemic.
And as an academic, did you find that the pandemic really helped focus minds in a way that hasn't happened in your experience? Because, you know, the need to do something was so acute. Therefore, people perhaps who maybe would have taken longer to respond, should we say, were perhaps keener to get involved and more kind of agile in the way of thinking.
Yeah, I think, as you say, agility and going into a responsive mode was obviously something that kind of had to happen given the situation. And I think what was really interesting and what we found was that we saw a range of evidence-based approaches being implemented rapidly across Greater Manchester. So the underserved groups in this area, which included people from ethnic minority backgrounds, but also in this context, underserved groups included homeless people, individuals with learning difficulties, in some contexts also pregnant women and young people. So there were a range of specific communities that needed bespoke approaches to enhance vaccination in these groups. And so we saw a particular focus on improving access, so to encourage targeted vaccination. So whilst mass vaccination centres were obviously incredibly important, it became apparent that there was a need to enhance that core delivery with bespoke, community-focused offers of locations for vaccination. And so we saw the increased use of what were colloquially called pop-ups. So those were kind of temporary vaccination centres that were often took place in community settings where people felt more confident and comfortable, and also there was a level of convenience in attending for vaccination. But what was really clear from the work we did, and I know this has been echoed in other work, is that the improved access to vaccination was often only successful if that was dovetailed with coordinated community engagement activities. And again, this echoes what's been said previously. So it's absolutely vital that to improve targeted vaccination, community engagement needs to be undertaken to co-design these targeted vaccination activities. So whether that's simple things like using telephone calls to remind people about vaccinations and the use of non-verbal communication text-based channels such as WhatsApp messaging, or door-to-door engagement by local volunteers, again, ideally from the local community. That dovetailing of interventions to increase access alongside improved communication is absolutely vital. And I think that, again, echoing what's been said before, the underpinning points that are a constant through all the activities that were undertaken were about the need for community engagement and wider partnership working. So going back to your original question in terms of how the pandemic catalysed activity, so I think engagement, successful community engagement, which was so integral for targeted vaccination activity, was often built on existing relationships with community residents through either established groups or creating new forums to listen and respond to people's vaccination concerns. So as Aoife says, the use of community connectors or community champions has been shown, certainly in our work, to be support success in this area. Those champions can act as important links between care delivery staff and target communities. And investment in that as a model of continuing to try and ameliorate inequalities in delivery of health and social care seems really important. And more widely, I guess, what we found was that there was a crucial role for voluntary community and social enterprise sector in this, and often links to community champions and sometimes faith leaders was leveraged through the VCSE sector. And that's not without resource implications for that sector. And I think many people felt that the value offered by that sector in improving targeted vaccination activities recognised only in one dimension the value that that sector has in helping to reduce inequalities and increase health equity. And I think fundamentally, and this goes back to something that you mentioned, that this is about building trust and relationships. And the pandemic provided a situation when that needed to happen rapidly, often leveraging on existing relationships, but encouraging those to develop because of essentially an emergency. And there's a focus locally, certainly, on trying to ensure that that trust that's being encouraged and the relationships that are developing aren't lost now that the pandemic's over, because that's at the heart of how community engagement can ultimately be one aspect of aiming to reduce health inequalities.
I'm really impressed with everything you've been saying, Joe, and I think it really embodies the, you know, that kind of positive community-based approach. And as you said, that building that trust seems to be the real kind of essence of making this work. And I think what we're seeing as well, and I'm sure it's the same in Greater Manchester, we're seeing a real holistic approach to healthcare, kind of building on the COVID vaccination campaign. So we're finding a lot of people are very opportunistically doing some smoking cessation advice or a very brief intervention about blood pressure checks or cancer screening even. And we've been really impressed with the community pharmacies. So in their vaccination campaigns, they've been sort of opportunistically counselling young women who might want to get pregnant about how to live healthily and how to do the best for the baby, and then older people on cancer diagnosis and even mental health physical checks. And I've also heard about dental practices who are checking blood pressure of all adults that walk into the building and then referring them on through pharmacy into primary care. And I think, you know, we haven't quite got those pathways correct or maybe as streamlined as we'd like. But I just wanted to emphasise that, you know, that COVID vaccination campaign is sort of the foundation for this very broad kind of holistic approach to health inequalities, building on that trust and community engagement and leadership that we've seen established in the COVID vaccination campaign. So, yeah, thank you very much.
Well, we said at the start of the podcast, we're hearing from a team who have been evaluating and working with some of the most promising innovations. Let's just talk to one as an example. Joining us now is Sophie Lowry. Sophie is the Implementation and Involvement Manager from the Health Innovation Network and also ARC, the Applied Research Collaboration in South London. And also Sandra Tomlinson, who is a lay educator in the HEAL-D program, has been advising on this project as well. And both of you, very welcome. Thanks for joining us. First of all, tell us the idea behind this project and HEAL-D. What does it stand for and how has it developed?
Hi, HEAL-D. HEAL-D stands for Healthy Eating, Active Lifestyles, Diabetes. It was developed by a young lady, I call her a young lady, Dr. Louise Goff, who developed it because she identified a need in the Black African and Caribbean community around type 2 diabetes. And that need was actually that I suppose I would call it awareness of not having awareness of the foods that they were eating.
Just to build on what Sandra said there. So as Sandra mentioned, Louise Goff sort of identified this need. And so we actually know that in the UK, type 2 diabetes is a major health priority, and people who have type 2 diabetes already face a number of inequalities. So For example, I actually think it was about a third of people who died in hospital during COVID actually had type 2 diabetes. And so there's an inequality in itself with diabetes, but then there's even further inequalities, as Sandra mentioned, around people from African and Caribbean heritage who are more likely high risk of developing type 2 diabetes and high risk of developing it at a younger age. So what Louise and her team did was they actually highlighted that people from this community have inequalities in healthcare access and engagement, including actually accessing services for diabetes. So that's where HealD was kind of born from, about this this inequality and lack of access.
And how easy is it, or how hard is it perhaps, to put the word across to explain the reasons behind this, that it is, you know, for very good reason? I guess sometimes there must be a sense that you're preaching to people that isn't how to approach health, or is it?
One of the things I think in terms of approaching health, and especially with this community, was that Louise, and which I think made me respect the program more than anything else, was the fact that it was a program that came into the community to find out what the community wanted, rather than, and I always phrase it as, rather than sit at a desk and tell the community what they need. And I think that made the difference, and a very big difference, because now people felt part of it, part of the research from beginning to end. And how should I put it? Designed by the community, developed by the community, for the community.
And what difference has it made?
It's made, well, from feedback, it's made a lot of difference. Working on the program, I see the differences. It's a 7-week course, which combines lifestyle education, physical activity, to help the attendees develop a healthy lifestyle changes. The lifestyle changes, really, they're aware of them already. The thing is, what the information that's been provided for them that's vital and not out there is, what do they do with the foods that they know and eat? And that has always been the most important thing, I think, for me and the attendees, that we are now have access to that information, which we didn't have before. We do online classes, exercise classes, which is great, and they enjoy. I've seen people come along who says blatantly, I am not doing no exercise, I'm not into no exercising, and so on. And by the end of the seventh week, I've got them doing more than, I'm even shocked and surprised. You're actually doing that amount? And they are. Well put together program, not because I'm the one lay educator on it, but that because I was in need once, in the same position who are those who are attending the course. My husband, he was diagnosed with diabetes, and that's how I got involved with this, because there was no information. I had to do my own self-research to be able to look after him, because born Jamaican, not giving up his diet for anybody else. Yam, banana, dumplings, here we go. And that's when I met Louise. She called for a community champion from Diabetes UK. And I sort of popped in and asked her what she was doing. It was a thought. I'll never forget, it was a thought. And I decided I was going to stick with that thought. And here I am today. And in so doing, I've seen so much people who have been through this program. I'm so proud. I saw a picture today of one of our attendees. She was scared about attending a family wedding because of a lot of things, having to go and eat, her size, you know, a couple of other things. And, I saw a lovely picture. I cried because it was so beautiful to see her smiling when we first met her. You know, I think we all seen it, how people could get low knowing that they have diabetes and not knowing where to go. After attending these programs, they're telling me where to go. I'm now getting advice, and this is the beauty of it. It's a two-way thing. It's not only us imparting information. They have a lot that they're imparting to us as well, and we share with them. It's all about what? Having fun and being engaging. We're a happy family when we're together. Yeah, happy family, which I'm looking at all the faces smiling and I'm thinking, ooh, do I have your emails? I would love to invite you guys to a session to come and join us. But yes.
Sophie, I mean, crikey, who needs to say any more than that? That sounds brilliant. I mean, has it worked as you wanted it to work, this program?
Yeah, I can't really add to that, can I? So I guess I come from a slightly different angle, from the sort of HSN ARC angle. And yeah, HEAL-D is a fantastic intervention that we are so, so supportive of. We're really proud of it as a local, local thing that's been designed locally, as Sandra said, talking about the whole co-design process. And that's really what's made it a really different and engaging and a program that just really works. So yeah, from our point of view, that's exactly what we want to see as an AHSN, is something that is implemented, is implementable, and there is a need out there for it. And that's exactly what HEAL-D is.
And I wonder, just in terms of people, numbers of people who've taken part, the stats, NHS love, we love our stats, don't we? But when it comes to sort of the effect it's had, is it too early to say yet, or can you see already there's been a positive change?
So I can't remember off the top of my head the number of people that have been through the course. Sandra might know better than me. Lots.
I don't keep count. We've done so many of them that I don't keep count, to tell you the truth. But I've been there from the beginning, so the numbers will be quite big for me in terms of how many has been through it. But the one thing I do know, I do have contact with a few of them who have been, and they're still continuing on their journey. They're enjoying it, having fun, and they're shouting it. That's the thing, they're shouting it out there. They're constantly telling me, I'm telling someone, I'm sharing what I've learned, and I'm also telling them that this program exists as well. So,
and Sophie, is it fair to say the insights prioritization program, this was instrumental in making this what happened in the first place, or as be as successful as it has been?
So HEAL-D was developed before the National Insights Prioritisation Programme. As Sandra mentioned, she's been involved in this for, I think, coming on to 10 years now. It's been in development. But what the NIP programme allowed us to do was actually really kind of take it to the next stage, I guess. So HEAL-D as an intervention is still in the research, within the research process and the research life cycle. And what the NIP allowed us to do was to kind of trial a bit more of the implementation. I could tell you a bit more about the NIP project ourselves. But basically, our NIP project, we had two work streams. So we had a evaluation work stream and a scale-up work stream. So the evaluation allowed us to see some of what you were saying, Nigel, about some of the figures and things. So we looked at, rather confusingly, our evaluation also had two work streams within it. One was assessing the service evaluation, basically assessing the feasibility and acceptability of the HEAL-D program. And so to do that, we used interviews with service users, interviews with service delivery staff, observations, and looked at service delivery, service level data as well. So things like we do a post-course questionnaire at the end of HEAL-D, which asks people about perceptions around losing weight, as well as they how did they find the course generally, and also exploring level of diabetes distress, which is measured pre and post post intervention. So we had a service evaluation element of the evaluation. We also had a scale up element of the evaluation, which was looking at the factors affecting scale up across other areas of England. So we spoke to commissioners and service providers in other parts of the country, looking at what their current provision is and what would help support them to potentially implement HEAL-D further down the line. And we also, as part of that work, conducted some focus groups with people from members of the public from the community outside of South London, specifically looking at digital accessibility. Because HEAL-D is actually now delivered as a online course, but it was originally designed as face-to-face, as everything changed during COVID, as we know. So it's now delivered online. So that's something we wanted to explore as part of the NIP program, which the program really allowed us to do. So that was the kind of evaluation element of our work. But then we also had this scale, sort of preparing for scale element as well, which was led by another one of my colleagues at the Health Innovation Network. And this was looking at preparing key resources to basically engage with areas outside of South London to raise awareness about the course, explore potential areas where HEALDY could be implemented. And this actually also included running two pilots in Greater Manchester as well. That's our NIP project in a nutshell.
Excellent stuff. And it's good to hear it's already been kind of taken up in other parts of England rather than just South London. And I'm not surprised though, because certainly you're infectious, you know, the work that the fact this had such an impact is brilliant to hear. And Sandra, you were saying before the reason for your involvement was very personal, your husband. I've got to ask, how is he doing now? What's life like for him?
He's not going to go into remission on diabetes because he was caught late. The main thing was for me was just making sure that, you know, he lives as long as having the right information to make that happen more than anything else. And as I said, it was the food. I knew it was always the food that was the problem. What I didn't have, I wasn't educated on, you know, things like the Caribbean, we eat, we enjoy our foods and we eat. We're not educated in terms of the amount of carbohydrates. We know it's carbohydrates, but the amount, how much of it we're eating. And we eat full plates. We love our food, so we do that. However, together with my research and then being on HEALD, I managed to learn quite a lot for myself, which now he's adapted. I don't have to babysit him anymore, give thanks. And with that, decided that, hang on, if I felt like the way I felt going through this, how was others feeling? So when Louise came up with this, at the time, it was just perfect because I realized there was a need. And I decided that I would devote my life to HEALD in terms of ensuring to follow it, to see where it goes. Not so much the working on it. I just want to keep an eye on it to make sure that it stays in the system, it be able to get to the people. And if it doesn't, I will say this upright, I'm happy to take what I've learned and go out there in the community and do it for myself. But I don't want to do that because I know where it is in the system. Happy for it to be there. Just want it to do the job that it needs to do.
It'll be a poor man who doesn't listen to you, Sandra. I hope your husband is very well aware of how lucky he is.
He hears my cry. I really do. Thank you.
Well, good to talk, Sandra. Oh. And Sammy, thanks for joining. Please stay with us and listen to that. It's Aoife Molloy from NHS England. She's the NHS England Senior Clinical Advisor, and also Professor Joe Dunville, Professor of Applied Health Research at University of Manchester. I mean, ask you both, what do you think about the project you've just been hearing about? You can't fail, sure, to be impressed by it.
It's absolutely fantastic, isn't it? Just absolutely amazing. And I suppose the thing I that really jumped out at me, I guess, looking for synergies in terms of what we've been talking about today, was just that value of co-design and co-production and working together with the people and local communities to produce activities and services like this. It's just inspirational.
I'd love to say a little bit more about that, actually, because that's been a really key part of it. So as we've spoken about, HEALD as itself was co-designed as an intervention, but that's something that we've really wanted to emphasize through the NIP project as well. And when we submitted our application right from the very start, we built in involving people in a meaningful way. So, because we wanted to make sure that we kept people as the heart of HEALD basically and kept that as the focus. So not only just having evaluation activities like the interviews and focus groups that involved people who've done HEALD or people with lived experience, but we also wanted people to support at a slightly higher level as well. So I'll let Sandra say a little bit more about it because she was actually part of the group, but we had a reference group of people who had been through HEALD and including Sandra as well, who really guided our work. Sandra, I'll let you talk rather than me.
Thank you. So for the NIP, the NIP project did incorporate the HEAL-D, what I would say, principle in terms of involving the community. So those of us, and I say us because I'm on the NIP project as well, in terms of giving feedback, looking at the rebranding, took it outside of the building and went to visit a church in North London to get feedback from the local community there. We went to North London because, as you know, we're based in South London with the project. So we had already done South London, so we needed to get somewhere else. So North London was somewhere we went to get feedback, and that was a great response. That was fun, actually. It was a nice day as well. In terms of feedback, the group has done videos. We've been invited to redo the videos for HEAL-D. We've looked at the branding. We've made recommendations and suggestions on changing things and putting things in, looking at the questionnaire. So the thing for me, what the NIP has done has kept with HEAL-D original methods of doing things, co-designing with the community, not the other way around, where most times, like I said this before, it's written and then handed over. No, this is, the questions are asked. You come with your open questions, you get the answers, come back, put them together, come back to the community and present them, and the community has a say. And I really do believe in it. I believe in it so much that I've asked myself this question, and I'm going to ask this out loud, maybe because it's NHS England. If we have this hard to reach communities, co-design, to me, watching what Louise has done, has shown that these communities are not as hard to reach as they seem to be made out to be. And that isn't co-design a way in? Even if they're hard to reach, can't co-design now be used more for getting into these communities? Because these communities, it's not that they don't want to be involved, they want to be involved. But there's another thing, how do we become involved? How do we get involved? I'm curious, any little thing drop on my desk, I go after it. But not everybody's like that. What happened with HEAL-D actually showed that sometimes we have to come to the community to help the community. It's not all the time the community is gonna come asking for help, because there's too many places, they don't know who to go to and where. But you come to the community and ask, yeah, the doors are open. They're not hard to reach. The doors are open. Believe me, they're all open. It's just getting someone to come to them to help them. But I believe in co-design.
Aoife, what do you think about that? Bit of a challenge.
I 100% agree with you, Sandra, and you know, I really admire your passion, and I really firmly believe that, you know, co-production is the answer. And what you've described also really makes me think of the power of peer support, you know, that kind of community collaboration and feeling like somebody else is going through a similar thing and understands you and can share those experiences. It's much more powerful than being told what to do by the NHS or by a clinician. And your example just really shows that in so many ways, from your family and then all your work and the impact that you're demonstrating in the evaluation. So I 100% agree. And it was really reminding me of the NIHR, so the National Institute for Healthcare Research, their commitment to broadening out what research we have available, because you're absolutely right that, you know, there are communities where we don't understand, it's not in the literature, it's not published in the papers on how to really improve health inequalities. And, you know, with the NIHR commitment to broadening out who joins in the research and who designs the research, you know, I think you're kind of a good few steps ahead of the game here. And I would love to be able to amplify and, you know, showcase your work, because I think if imagine, you know, spreading it from South London to North London and then beyond, you know, around the country, I think, you know, we could definitely at NHS England give you that platform to sort of share your successes and learning as well along the way.
I totally agree, and I just something you said, Sandra, struck a chord with me, because I think your point about groups not being hard to reach, although that label's used too, you know, too much, because I agree it's not right. Groups aren't hard to reach. They are underserved by us and the people who work in this area. So I think it's definitely a term that you know, we should try and move away from using in some ways, because it's not that people are hard to reach, it's that we're not necessarily very good at reaching them.
Don't make yourself too hard. It's not about not in a way reaching them. There's a system that's developed, and I just think the way it's developed, nobody took in consideration that there may be a need to have to go out. That's all. I think that's
yeah,
where it is.
Yeah.
Don't knock it.
No, I think it's great, and it loops back round to the importance of partnership working and community engagement and building those relationships.
Yes. Thank you. I really think it is important, and I would love to see you guys get together on it. I'll be keeping an eye.
I'm sure we will. How can we not, after being encouraged as keenly by you, Sandra, and Sophie, of course. Thank you very much. Thanks to our guests in this edition of the podcast, Aoife Molloy from NHS England. She's the Senior Clinical Advisor for Health and Equality. Professor Jo Dunville, Professor of Applied Health Research at the University of Manchester. And Sandra Tomlinson, who's a lay educator working with the Afro-Caribbean community in South London. If you'd like to learn more about the NHS Insights Prioritisation Programme, go to the AHSN Network website. I'm Nigel Thompson. Until next time, thanks for listening.